Welcome to the Boomer Woman's podcast, where we are embracing the journey. I'm your host, Agnes Knowles. There comes a point where many of us begin to ask a different kind of question, not about what we're building, but about what we're giving back. And that question isn't always easy to answer, because somewhere along the way, giving became tied up with doing it right. And yes, I just used air quotes on right. Choosing the right cause, giving the right amount, making the right impact. But what if giving back isn't about getting it right at all? Today's conversation explores what it really means to contribute, whether through time, money, or simply paying attention to what matters to you. Before we begin, a quick note. Catherine and I connected while she was in Eastern Europe, so you may notice her audio has a slightly different quality. Stay with us, though. This is a conversation worth hearing. And with that, let's get into my conversation with Catherine Lacefield. My guest today is speaking to a part of many of us that doesn't get talked about enough. Because while we may not all be out there running fundraising campaigns or building nonprofits, a lot of us are at a stage where we're asking, how do I give back in a way that actually matters? Catherine has been living in that world for a long time, from activism as a teenager to working inside nonprofits to now helping organizations rethink how they raise money and connect with people. She also talks about non-human philanthropy. Those areas are very near and dear to my heart, especially as I watch my grandchildren grow up. And then she says she has a love of conversation, a bit of humor, and a whole lot of real-world experience. So I think we're in for a really meaningful chat. Catherine Lacefield, welcome to the Boomer Woman's podcast, where we are embracing the journey.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
And just for listeners, I got to say that Catherine's in Albania. So I really appreciate the fact that she managed to get through to my scheduler and she's here now. So this is exciting.
Yeah.
Okay, Catherine, we're going to go back to age 15. What started you on this path at age 15?
So back then, I was in high school, of course, and I was part of an IBO program. So it was really the International Baccalaureate. So we had forced or mandatory volunteer hours as of grade 7. So I grew up basically as soon as I was a teenager, 12 years old, I was doing volunteer work. And another aspect of our program was also what they called areas of interaction. So every single project, assignment, even almost exam that we did, we had to associate it with kind of like a real world, like how is this actually helping us? And one of them was the environment. So a lot of projects ended up being connected to more the environmental space or how is this impacting the environment or what's the connection to the environment. So I've always been very sustainable minded. And I remember falling on those famous, horrible to watch PETA videos where they talk about factory farming, about the impact on the environment of the animal world. And I was like, how can I continue saying I'm environmentally friendly if I'm also directly supporting factory farming by consuming meat? So I became vegetarian. And I have a little funny story about that where I told my mom, we were six kids at the time, so it was a big, busy house. And I was like, Mom, I have something to tell you. I really want to become a vegetarian. And at first, she was like, That's amazing. Congratulations. So, are you going to go to school for that? And I was kind of confused. Like, what? What do you mean? Like, why would I go to school?
A
And I'm like,
veterinarian.
And she's like, Oh, you're going to be a veterinarian. I'm like, No, Mom, a vegetarian. And she's like, No, please, not that. So that's kind of what got me into the animal welfare activism. I was kind of that annoying teenager that was trying to always do something for the animals over the for the planet. So that's kind of my little funny founding story of my activism life.
Well, it's interesting because I had teenage daughters. I had two of them. And it seems to me that, and don't take this in a bad, nasty way, but every teenage girl out there goes through a phase
The face.
where she's going to be a vegetarian. Now, in fairness, my eldest daughter is coming up 41 or something like that. And she's still vegetarian and she is raising her kids vegetarian. So, yeah, so kudos to you all. Now, a few years have passed since age 15.
Quite a few.
You've been involved in different arenas now of the nonprofit and gifting area. How has your idea of doing good, and I just used air quotes for listeners, doing good, changed over the years?
Well, when I started, of course, I was kind of that doe-eyed, optimistic, we're going to change everything. And there's like this perfect way. And we have to follow this perfect way. And there's only one way of doing good. So a lot of times in a lot of movements, there's a lot of infighting within organizations because there's people that are fighting over what is the best way to re achieve a certain result. And in the vegan world, let's just say it, it's a lot, it's very extreme. It's very much, there's one way you can only support animals if you're 100% vegan, if you're doing all of this stuff, and you have to be perfect. There's very much this perfection mind around it. And for many years, I lived by that until I burnt out completely and I was exhausted. Every decision you make every day, you have to think about, oh, this is supporting animal cruelty, and you're just thinking about it all the time. And I started seeing that I was pushing away people and I was getting people to be more annoyed by the movement than anything else. So I really started taking a step back. My husband, bless him, honestly really helped me take a step back, take care of myself, and figure out that no one is perfect. No one needs to be perfect. And there are many, many ways of reaching your goal. So this is where I started talking more about the interconnection between causes. I started thinking about how everyone has their role to play and everyone can participate to their own level. And we don't have to be perfect. So that's definitely one of the big things that has changed for me over the years. You can be a donor, you could be a volunteer, you could work in the nonprofit space, you could be an advocate just in your own community. There's so many ways to give back, and they're all equally valuable. Everyone tends to put some on a pedestal, and I'm doing better than you, and this competition really has to stop.
Yeah, I can really see how competition is really going to put a glitch
It's
in the
toxic.
overall, yeah, the finish line, what that looks like.
Exactly.
Now we have mid-age women out there, and they're thinking, I'd like to give back, but I don't even know where to begin. Do you have any suggestions for them?
Many. First,
That's why you're
figure
here.
out. Yeah, that's why I'm here. It really depends on obviously where your heart lies, what your passion is. So a lot of people say that there's this big movement of efficient philanthropy, efficient altruism, of like we need to go into what's the most efficient per dollar impact in the world. I think that's an interesting way of looking at things, and I think there are people that will be very motivated by that rational argument. But let's be honest. We're not very rational human beings for the most part. We have to go with what makes your heart sing, as cheesy as that sounds. For me, it's animals. That's what makes me happy. I'm flying with a dog from Albania to Montreal because she's been waiting in the shelter for a year and a half because no one adopts dogs in Albania. So for
Oh, okay.
me, it is like that makes my day. I get so excited calling Air Canada, figuring out the flight to be able to save this dog's life. That's what makes me feel good. And at the end of the day, when we feel good about something, then we tend to stay in it and then we tend to have the most impact. Which is also why I help and fundraise for nonprofits in the animal sector, because I care about it and I'll be more passionate about it and I'll do a better job. So I would always tell people, what would be like your perfect job? Because usually it doesn't exist as a job. You could probably do it as a volunteer though. Or you can get involved in a cause that would make you happy. If you love penguins, maybe it's something with penguins. If you love reading, maybe it's reading to the elderly or reading to young children or whatever it may be. Going with where your passion lies and seeking out nonprofits that work in that space. And now with ChatGPT and with Google and with, if you're in Canada, Charity Village has a great repertoire of volunteer opportunities. You can find that place very, very easily now. And then try it out. Don't feel bad about needing to commit to something 100% right away. Just you need to test things out and see where you feel most comfortable. Because even if it's the right cause, it might not be the right organization. You might need to play around a bit. But networking is a great way of figuring out a lot of these things as well.
Right. And it sounds too like because a lot of midlife women, especially if they've retired, they may be struggling a little bit financially. Giving time in one way or the other is probably a really nice way to fulfill a need within yourself. And, I did a bit of research on this a whole bunch of years ago, and sometimes that volunteer can lead into a part-time job or something like that as well. And then you're
100%.
supplementing your income.
Yeah, that's how I started working at the Montreal SPCA, actually. I started as a volunteer. I was a volunteer for a year, loved it. I was there much more than I should have. And when the position opened in the foster department, I was the first person they thought of. So many times I was on a board for 7 years. And then when they needed a fundraising expert, who do you think they hired? Because I knew the organization. There's many ways to eventually work in the nonprofit, but let's be honest, that's often not the best paid jobs. However, there are very well-paid positions in the nonprofit sector as well, especially if you have certain skills, an accountant, lawyer, legal advice, like their HR. There's definitely many opportunities, and a lot of people don't think about working in the nonprofit sector, but there is a huge demand for working in there right now. Like they're looking for jobs all the time, looking for employees, sorry.
Okay, everybody knows I come with notes. You've just jumped ahead because I will admit, years ago, I actually considered becoming a professional fundraiser. I'd been to a workshop and this person was talking about it, partly because I loved the idea and partly because I heard they made really good money, some of them.
It
Okay.
depends.
Oh no, and that's why I said some of them.
Yes.
So, how do you balance meaningful work with earning a living?
Well, it was a journey. Let's just say that. In the beginning, when I was working in an animal rights organization, I was severely underpaid. This is another thing of certain sectors or certain grassroots organizations, like they will expect so much for so little because there's this martyrdom of like, well, if you care about the cause, you'll give it everything and not expect anything back so you can give more money to animals. And I think that that's a very toxic belief system. However, now I do the exact same thing for my consulting business, but it's my business and I get paid a lot more because it's my business. So there's different things. What's difficult in fundraising is in the US, there's a lot more of this acceptance around commission-based fundraising pay, which is more motivating for the person, or bonuses, like you have a base pay and you get bonuses. However, according to the Association of Fundraising Professionals, so AFP, commission-based fundraising is considered unethical because you're going to be pressuring people and you're going to be getting a benefit. I disagree. I think that if you end up with a larger pie for your charitable organization, but there's a higher percentage going towards fundraising, at the end of the day, you have more resources to fund your mission. I think that's more important than any percentage. Of course, there's always limitations, but still, I would say to get to a level where you're getting a good enough salary, it's usually based on years of experience and what kind of fundraising you're doing. So major gifts or fundraising development, fundraising, if you're the main fundraising staff. So making your way up that can be a bit difficult unless you have great sales experience and you just get a knack for it. So there are some organizations that will give you a choice or a chance. More and more, I think there's a lot of good fundraisers out there going into fractional fundraising. So if people are looking for a side job, this can actually be a really great opportunity. There's trainings available where you kind of become like a part-time employee for a nonprofit to do their fundraising because not all of them need full-time fundraising staff. And you're just a contractor, so you don't have to deal with, they don't have to pay the taxes and the employment and complicatedness, and you get side fundraising. That's what I do with a lot of my clients, and it works really well.
Okay, I'm going to get into the money side of it in a minute. But you've mentioned things like monthly giving and peer-to-peer campaigns. Can you explain that and what makes those approaches so effective?
So monthly giving is really important for a lot of nonprofits. So if you're looking to give back, even joining a month as a monthly donor at like $10 a month makes a huge difference for a lot of nonprofits, by the way. And the reason why is that by growing your monthly donor base, you have stable recurring funds coming into your organization that is open-ended. So for anyone who's new to the fundraising space, grants tend to be very project-based. So they'll fund just for your project, but you can't pay for your employees, you can't pay for your the rent, you can't pay for electricity. Like it's It's very limiting. So a lot of times that overhead that is seems like it's evil, which is actually what's fun, like making your organization work, tends to have a harder time getting funded. When you have monthly donors, you can guarantee that your base costs are covered every single month. And acquisition costs, so like to get new donors, is very expensive. And once they're monthly, the return on investment, if I could say, is better because they'll stay on average for up to 4 times longer because it's automatic. And they tend to give up to 2 times more when they're monthly because it's easier to budget when it's monthly instead of paying it at the end of the year. So that's the great part about monthly giving. For peer-to-peer, there's pros and cons, like with every fundraising strategy. The benefit of peer-to-peer is that you're bringing in new people from outside of your immediate circle of donors. So instead of asking for your donors, hey, give us a donation, you're asking them, hey, would you fundraise in your network and in your communities to raise money for the organization? So you tend to be getting in new dollars and new potential donors that would want to stay in the long term. And most of the work is being done by these donors or by your ambassadors, by other people in the community. So it tends to be a lot less work, but in a way that's a lie because managing your ambassadors, doing the campaigns, it's still a lot of work. But if you're looking to bring in money that is new or that is not going to over solicit your existing donors, peer-to-peer can be a great strategy. But warning, the retention rate of those new donors tends to be very low because they tend to be donating for the ambassador or for the person who solicited them, and not necessarily because they're super attached to the cause.
Okay. All right, now we can go back to money.
Talk about money.
And well, just in terms of, there is, you touched on this, the fact that, people look at administration costs and versus how much you're giving. How should we be thinking about that? What's fair, what's necessary, and what might we be misunderstanding? I think you just pointed out some of that insofar as keeping the lights on is a tangible thing.
It really is. And I think there's this mythical 15% administration rate that is seen as like the baseline. But this totally depends on what kind of work you do, where you are in the world, and where you are in even in Canada, different provinces, rent is maybe more expensive than in others. So you have to consider the context of every organization and also even what stage are they in their development. Are they a small startup that needs to invest in their staff, that needs to invest in these initial things, and they're not getting the big income? I'm sorry, they're not making this huge impact yet, but to get to that huge impact, they need to start with this investment. And a lot of times, those factors aren't taken into consideration. It's just this blanket 10% allowable administration fees, which is nothing. So, of course, there's always those scandals that we see that, oh my God, 60% of the donations were going towards administration. Yes, of course. There's some that will exaggerate and that will take advantage, quote unquote. But what I always tell people is look at the impact this organization has had. What maybe it's costing them 30% to fundraise, but they're raising millions of dollars versus a small organization that, yeah, can claim it only costs 5% for fundraising, but they're raising $50,000 a year. What's going to have more impact, $50,000 or the 50 million? Even if there's a percentage higher, like from a how much food can that buy for people? Like the millions is definitely more. So a lot of people tend to be very critical of the nonprofit sector without understanding that just like any business, they need to invest in themselves to grow, to scale up, and to learn. And sometimes that is the hardest lesson that a lot of nonprofits have to face, is that they're not allowed making mistakes. That is a very heavy weight
Okay, at the risk of sounding argumentative,
to Go for it.
I just know I'm glad you're here to explain some of this. A couple of years ago, I helped close down an estate from an elder who had passed. I can't tell you the stacks of cards that charities had sent her, the stacks of shopping list things with magnets to put on the fridge, the number of nickels that came in envelopes, all that sort of stuff. And I guess the question that begs to be asked, I'm begging to ask, is that
That efficient?
justifiable?
Personally, I don't think that's necessary in today's day and age. I don't think that we need to have that, I call it in French, des bébelles, like random stuff being sent by mail. But there is a certain segment of the population, generally the elderly, that are being sent physical mail because they're not online as much. So that could also be where it's being skewed. Like they're not sending this to everyone. And mailing, direct mail works very well for a big portion of the population to still give donations. However, there is a shelter that I used to work at that they got highly criticized because they were in this contract and they were sending stuff all the time. And then people end up feeling guilty of like, I have to make a donation because they spent this money on this stuff. So I don't think that's good practice, unless your donors really, really like that. And that's what they say they want. So for example, for a monthly donation program, there's some where they'll send you a little pin. Welcome to the team. Welcome to our community. I think that's cute. Does that mean that we need to send a pin every 2 weeks? No. I'm sending, so I'm in Albania, as you know, and I have a client in Albania. We went and we took some personalized photos with the dogs with a little whiteboard where we wrote, thank you, Anna. Thank you, Joanne. And we just took photos with the dogs and we're going to send them personalized emails with these. It's much more authentic and personalized than something else. But I'm also to our biggest donors, I grabbed some postcards from the city of Shkodër in Albania, where the shelter is. And I wrote them handwritten notes and I'm going to be mailing it to them. Hey, we're sending you a piece of Albania because there's a piece of you here because you're a monthly donor. Do I think that that's worth it? Yes. Because these people are donating $50, $60, $100 a month to help this organization run. That $5 that I'm spending on the postage and the card, 100% worth it. And I want to make them feel special. So I believe more in the authentic, personalized communications, be it via email, phone call, Zoom, whatever it is, sending random crap, you know? No, I think that that's a waste of everyone's time and money and resources. So much stuff that we don't need.
Okay, and here's another question, which I will admit I'm a little bit ignorant about because when the first email came, I went, what? And delete. And I have will not give again, insofar as thank you for your donation to a cause that I believed in. I still do believe in. But suddenly I'm entered in a draw to win $100,000. Where does the 100,000 come from?
So it depends. There's definitely 50-50 lotteries, but usually those are very clearly indicated. That's different, where you know everyone's giving in and they actually raise quite a lot of money to do that. But that's a strange situation. It could be a sponsorship. It could be, I don't know what the email was, but it could be that a company said, like, I will give you or I will donate $100,000. But then there must be something being exchanged there. Either they're getting visibility throughout this person's emailing list, or maybe there's even a list exchange, but then you would have needed to consent to that. So I don't know what the context is. I've done giveaways before, but it's usually for like, you get two tickets to the national park, you know, like at $100,000, like. So I don't know. That's an interesting context, and I would be very curious to like figure out what's behind that. Most likely, the money must be coming from a sponsor or an external donor. But it's weird that it was sent to you after. Like I would have said that's a useful way of getting people in the door more so than saying after. That's a very strange mechanism.
Okay, I feel a little bit justified.
Yeah, no, that's weird.
Okay, now you also touched on this a few minutes ago, and I have to look at my notes here. People are starting to look at data and measurable impact before they donate and asking, where does my dollar do the most good. How do you feel about that? I get the impression that it's sometimes.
It's difficult because some work is very hard to measure in that way. Give you two examples. Animal shelter. You can very clearly say X amount of dogs, X amount of cats, this is what it costs in veterinary and vaccines and deworming and whatever. I work for another organization that does lobbying and education around the use of pesticides and GMOs in Quebec. So their campaigns take up to 10 years to stop the production of GMO salmon, for example. How do you quantify that? In the first year, we sent out press releases, we sent out email, we're putting pressure. It's harder to have that direct measurement. 15 years later, now we can say we did this, we did that, we did this, we did that. Can I say where each dollar went? It went to salaries because that's what's needed. Then that's not sexy. So it really depends on which sector of work we're talking about, and also what is valuable data to you. Some people are moved by the rational argument. Some people are moved by the storytelling. If you hear my dog this time,
Yeah, there you go.
Mr. Pickles. Sometimes it's the storytelling, right? Like you might be moved by an individual story instead of by the numbers. So some work is easier and goes further. Like $1,000 in Albania helps a lot of dogs. $1,000 in the US maybe helps one or two. So there's also so many other factors that will influence how far your dollar goes. And at the end of the day, is that the only measurement of the efficiency of an organization?
Okay, so we just heard Mr. Pickle. Mr. Pickles, is that his name?
Mr. Pickles, who is
Okay.
unhappy
So
dog.
one thing I've wondered about, and there's no right or wrong as far as I can see. It's just all about the people and the organizations, et cetera. But you said you're going to fly a dog over to Canada for adoption. There's so many dogs in Canada that need adopting. Where
Why?
Well, I guess because you hear about it. I mean, here on the west coast of Canada, we get Mexico, we get a lot of the Central American countries, that sort of thing.
Why?
Yeah, why?
And I would usually say I'm on the other side of the situation of usually saying we shouldn't. But in Canada, so this partner that I work with, who she started the organization in Albania, and she also happens to work at the Montreal SPCA, where in 6 days every dog gets adopted. So she has enough, she doesn't bring in 30 dogs. She's bringing in one. Like I think it's a question of numbers. And usually what rescues do is they make sure to have a home before. So that they're not bringing it to shelters, of course. And do I think it's efficient? Do I think it's rational? Not at all. But this is why rescue work is not rational. It's emotional. And this dog that I saw that she got hit by a car in December 2024 as a puppy, they treated her and she's grown up in this shelter. She's this beautiful dog, sweet as can be. And she spent a year and a half in a cage because the adoption rate in Albania is 5%. Are they doing things to change that? Yes, they're doing education, awareness. They're getting parents to come to meetings to understand because kids want the dogs, but the parents are like, no. They're doing everything they can to change the culture in Albania, but that's going to take years upon years. They're also doing spay-neuter campaigns so that there's less animals, but there's a problem right now. So they're finding as much solutions as they can because everyone wants their dog and their shelter to get adopted. But it's not an easy topic. And now in Canada, you're technically not allowed to be bringing in unless it's your dog. So online, like Angel is going to be my dog on this flight. So they did put limitations because Canada is now back into the overpopulation. Because during COVID, shelters were empty. So it was like, bring the
And all
dogs.
those dogs have come back now.
And
Not all, a lot of
a
them,
lot of
yeah.
them have come back. But So just to talk about this quickly, a lot of the times the abandonment situation in Canada is very different from, let's say, in Mexico or in Albania, where it's street animals reproducing. The reasons why people are abandoning in the most part is because of housing issues. It's because people are not allowed having pets in their apartments. That's actually one of the main reasons on the West Coast in Vancouver. So it's a social issue. It's not because people don't care about their pets. It's not because we have an overpopulation problem in the same way of Mexico and Albania. It's because of other social issues. Women or men leaving domestic violence, fleeing domestic violence, that need a place to go, and all shelters don't allow dogs. So there's amazing organizations that come in fostered for this. There's a lot of them in the West Coast that I actually know. But I actually am writing a paper right now that should be published in May that's talking about the interconnection between a lot of our social issues, food insecurity, the rising cost of food, housing issues, domestic violence, drug addiction, and addictions in general. Those are some of the key reasons why people are bringing in animals to shelters nowadays. People think it's because people are heartless and people, oh, you should have thought about it. It's mostly because people are going through a crisis themselves. So, anyways, just putting that into context, like there's a lot of things that we can do to make people be able to keep their pets so they don't have to abandon them. And that way, there wouldn't be as much of a problem in Canada. Anyway. Sorry for getting on
Yeah,
my soapbox.
no, that's a soapbox that I'm on there with you, because my last dog has passed now, but for the last number of years of her life, I can't tell you what my options were for accommodations, because she was a mid-sized dog. I had a few people say, oh yeah, she's under 35 pounds. And I'm going like, I can barely lift her up, thank you. I can
Let's
lift a
just put on a
35
diet.
pound. Yeah, right. You know,
It's very
so yeah, no,
challenging.
so I do get that. Now I'm going to ask you a question I don't know if you can answer. In Canada, I think we're no kill. I know there's lots of places in the US that have a high kill rate. Globally, is it more kill
So
rate or no kill rate?
even the no-kill label is misleading in a way, because if there's one place that's no-kill, it's because there's another place that. So it's very hard to get a no kill in an entire region. There are. In the New England area, generally, they don't have to euthanize. They're actually in bringing in dogs from the South. They have partnerships because, but then I have clients in Texas, for example, where it's a different situation. And they are trying to go towards no kill. But it's often just like it goes with social inequalities. It's often in places where there is social inequities, where there's less job opportunities, there's less education, there's just less resources, that they become high kill and they're seen as like evil. It's like, well, they don't have the resources and no one is investing in this spay neuter and no one's offering free vet care. And let's be honest here, vet care is so expensive. So in Canada, not everywhere is no kill at all. There's definitely places in the north or in more rural areas that have huge overpopulation problems, and they end up being not no kill. And even no kill is just in other than in cases of emergency or when it's a humanitarian euthanasia, of course. So just to make that clear, a lot of places just don't have pickles.
That's all right.
A lot of people just. A lot of cities just don't have anything to manage their animal population. So there's just, they don't have any resources at all. So in some places, they use mass poison campaigns on the streets. And often you will see it before there's the Olympics or a FIFA World Cup in a country, mass killing campaigns and culling campaigns of all their dogs on the streets. And it's not sustainable because there's always going to be new ones that come. So you have to still spay neuter them because they're also just other dogs from elsewhere are going to be like, oh, new territory. And they're just going to move in. But anyway, I would say it's definitely worse in other places in the world. Canada and the US, even in the US, is still not as bad as other places. But yeah, it varies greatly per region.
Well, I won't go there, but I will add that humans get equally displaced pre-Olympics, pre-FIFA, etc. So, but anyways.
100%.
Okay, so we've been talking a lot of dogs. That qualifies, I believe, as non-human philanthropy.
Yes.
The environment. Now, human philanthropy would be like what? Cancer, human, or like
Human
things that happen.
services,
Okay,
community
yeah.
organizations. I invented the term, but some people started thinking that I was talking about AI, and I was like, no,
Oh.
that's not what I mean. It was anything that is not directly associated with helping humans, but let's be honest, humans are definitely affected positively by a lot of these strategies and these causes anyway. But it was more focused on animals, be it wildlife or domestic animals, be it factory farmed animals, whatever, all animals or the environment. So ecosystems, the health of our water, lakes, et cetera.
Yeah, and I think I mentioned in my intro that as my grandchildren are growing now, my focus on the environment is huge. It has been for a while. It's not just because of the grandchildren. And I find myself getting irritated when, I see things like soft plastic going in the garbage, like, oh, just all the little things that just, irritate. Talk about non-human philanthropy for a minute, for, well, more than a minute.
So for me, the motivation, kind of how I started the interview, was that's how I got involved, right? So that's kind of where it started. But I was always very interested in the human aspect because when I was working at the animal shelter, one of the sentences I would hear the most was, "I hate humans." And I was like, wow, that's harsh. Like, we're humans and we're working at the shelter. Who's adopting our animals? Who's fostering our animals? Who's donating to help our animals? All humans. So there was like this disconnect. This is why I like using the non-human as like almost a test. Because at the end of the day, we're all connected. Cancers, health issues are directly linked to our environment. Animals can help people with health issues by lowering their chances of heart disease, by lowering stress. Like, I don't know about you, but like, I can spend my entire day petting my little dog, and it makes me just feel so happy. Even if I've had him for almost 2 years, his mere presence helps me mentally, physically. So I don't see anything as separate, and yet we tend to see them as like, oh, but little story. When I was fundraising for animal rights on the streets of Montreal, those annoying people on the streets that are like, oh, we have 2 minutes to talk about such and such. Yeah, that was me for 5 years. I think I was a nice one, but anyways, this man came up to me and literally spat at me and said, "How dare you be protecting animals when there are children dying because of the war in Syria?" And it's like, I get it. We have a hierarchy of what we want to put as priorities in life. And I understand that for some people, animals should only come once you've helped all the people. But that's just unrealistic. It's not. People care about animals sometimes more than they care about people in foreign lands. And that's not saying that they're psychopaths. There's only so much things we can care about. And everyone has a passion, and everyone's piece of the puzzle will build the tapestry of what we need to actually solve a lot of these problems. So, and also, I almost felt like telling him, you have no idea what I do in my other life. Like, I support many organizations. I'm supporting Oxfam as a monthly donor right now, who is doing, so anyways, people, they tend to pigeonhole people into different categories.
I'm old enough to put someone on the spot. Did you tell him that if he donated $100 to his cause, or your cause, you would donate $100 to the work
To
he
his,
is doing personally for the children in Syria? Because I wonder
right?
if so many people need to mouth off, but they're not, there's no actions behind their words.
That's the beauty of social media, even worse now, right? So
Oh,
this
no,
one
for
was
sure.
actually in person, but
Yeah,
imagine
yeah.
social media. The complaining and it comes back to what I was saying about being perfect. Oh, you care about animals, but you're using a phone and the phone does this and it's encouraging children, or like the battery is mining and it's creating more. Like, everything we do as humans causes impact, has an effect on someone, something, somewhere. And so I think that there's this utopic idea, and everyone is so easy to criticize. And it's like, but what are you doing? And even then, it's not about, I don't want to criticize you. It's just understanding we're all human. And I think I would have liked to tell them that. And like, well, what are you doing? And if you told me, like, I have an organization, I would be like, amazing. Do you need fundraising advice? I can help you. Like, I'd be happy to. But instead, he came at it with an anger.
Mouthful
And
of gob, yeah.
it's just like, ugh. But this is why I tried. So my podcast actually is all about that, the interconnection between causes and how we need to work together. You don't know, maybe that by supporting human development in other places, you will definitely increase the well-being of animals because people are going to start having the capacity to think about their animals. So it's all the causes are connected at the
Yeah.
end of the
Okay, we're going to cheer up this conversation a little bit now.
day.
At this stage of life, many women are thinking about legacy, and once again, air quotes. Talk about legacy, giving in any form, how does it play into that?
So it's definitely, I think, something that a lot of charities are becoming more and more in tune to, especially with the aging generation of donors that there is now. And they're starting to think about what their legacy giving plans are going to look like. Now, it's very interesting from a fundraising perspective because legacy gifts are often, it's a 5 to 10 year investment in the sense of you never know when it's going to come in, right? You can't depend on it. So if you're interested, I would definitely like highly recommend telling the nonprofit that you would like to support, that you're interested. They will have someone in charge that can talk you through it and explain the different ways and how do you want the money to be spent, or do you want to invest in one particular program or not? Like, if you are curious into how you can have the most impact, have a conversation with the nonprofit. I actually have a donor. His name is Brian. He's like my favorite donor ever. So he's one of the donors at El Animals Need Me in Albania, and he reached out to us, and like he's only been with us for like a year, but we send him personalized emails. We're friends on Facebook now. I know he has a dog named Toby. We're talking on a regular basis. Like, we've built a relationship, not only with the intention of course, I know that that helps donations, but I'm genuinely interested in him. Like, he's a very nice guy. And he just reached out and was like, I just added you to my will. And the only thing I ask is that I would love to have a bench somewhere on the new shelter's property that people can go and sit and have a good time with their dogs and just relax because they don't have that at the shelter right now. And we're like, done. We'll do it before so you can come sit on the bench yourself, Like, so I think thinking about what's going to have the most impact, and also, do you want your impact to be in perpetuity? So in that way, do you want to add your money to an endowment so that that money will be continually generating revenue for the organization and supporting them through the long term, sorry. Or do you want the most impact today? So there's a lot of things that we need to think about before we make that kind of a decision, but a lot of people tend to change their minds several times throughout that process. But I would my recommendations would be to talk to any nonprofits and ask them, like, what is your legacy plan, like legacy giving program? There's going to be someone that can help you figure out, because there's many ways of giving, and I'm not an expert in that, so I won't go further into.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting too, being this age where I know women who are single, no kids, financially secure. And, it seems to me to be like a really good idea to do that legacy giving as opposed to letting the government take a huge chunk of
Yes. Why would you want to give it to your government? I mean, this is
it.
even when I left Canada, but and then also, like, you can, what I find cool is that you can plan your legacy now. It's like, it's exciting. There's a lot of people that they call it giving while living. Like, you can make the gift like as part of the endowment. There's ways of being able to do it today so that you're also seeing the impact of your gift happen before. So you get to actually see it before you leave.
There you go. And sit on that bench. What haven't we talked about that you want mid-age women to think about after listening to us chit chat here for a while? And if you could give our listeners just one simple thought about giving back, something they can sort of go forward with, what would that be?
Give nonprofits a break. If you're supporting them already, understand a lot of nonprofits are doing the best they can with very little. Sometimes a little email of like, I really support the work you do, thank you. Sometimes simple encouragements can make a really big difference for the people behind the emails, behind the screens that are working tirelessly every day. And also, don't minimize the impact that you can have, even if you're maybe you don't have the same energy that you used to at the peak of your career. It doesn't matter. Sometimes just having someone to come and show their support and be like, I'd love to help, means the world for a lot of organizations. And you can find a position that makes sense for you. And it doesn't have to be the most exciting one. And that's still having great impacts for a lot of nonprofits. My last word of wisdom. Repeat, what am I supposed to be sharing? The nuggets, like nuggets of
Well,
wisdom?
just yeah, is there anything we haven't talked about that that you just want people to think about?
Never feel bad about supporting a certain cause that you believe in. I think that there's, like I said, a lot of people that have this competition in between causes of like, well, you should be doing this one or this cause is better or whatever. Like, if you like the organization and it makes you feel good and they're doing work that you respect, stand by them. It might not be the most efficient one, but maybe they're doing it in a way that is not as efficient, but is having a different kind of impact. Everyone has their role to play. And so, like, being like not caring as much what other people say is something that I think is really important when we start trying to give back. Because no matter what you do, you're going to make someone unhappy. So, like, who cares?
Well, women my age have been bowing to pressure for a lot of years. I mean, for me, it was, French immersion or not French immersion, the local college or, the exotic university, like all that sort of stuff. So this is just one more. We can stick to our guns.
Yeah, just screw it. Who cares? Just do what makes you happy. And like that's all that matters. Like, I've gotten criticized for helping in Africa instead of helping in Canada, or like help, oh, in Zambia it's worse, or in the there's always a worse or a better somewhere else. And that's not the point. Doesn't matter.
Yeah, to thine own self be true.
Voila.
Where do we find you on the World Wide Web?
I'm very active on LinkedIn. I'm a LinkedIn fan, so definitely look me up. Catherine Lacefield, you can find me there if you're interested in learning more. If not, I do have a podcast where if you're interested in the non-human philanthropy aspect, you're interested in learning more about fundraising or about getting involved, you might find some really interesting conversations there. It's the Just Be Cause Consulting. No, I'm just saying my business now. The Just Because podcast. You can find it on Spotify, Apple, or on my website at justbecause.consulting/podcast.
Okay, I was waiting for you to come up with your website. So, yeah, and at the very bottom here, I see Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram. Are
Yeah.
the social medias active or?
I'm on Facebook and Instagram. Definitely Instagram is more stories of like my dogs and I doing silly stuff. But I do also post about the fundraising, but I'm more active from a networking perspective on LinkedIn. Facebook, it's just to say that I have a Facebook account, but not very active there, to be honest.
Okay. I do have one more question, and I don't know if you can answer it or not.
We shall see.
You're Canadian, I'm Canadian. Canada Revenue gives us some credit for our donations. Last year, I made a fairly sizable donation in someone else's name. I got the tax receipt, not them, and it was an offshore company, so I couldn't use the receipt myself. Do you know anything about tax implications? First of all, can tax receipts be requested in the name of the giftee, not the gifter? And how do we know if Canada Revenue or in the States the IRS accepts receipts from organizations? And as I say, you
Question.
may or may not be able to answer that, so.
I mean, I'm gonna start by saying I am not a tax, I'm
No,
not an
okay,
accountant or a tax person, so don't take this for gold, please. I know that usually in Canada, you need to have the receipt with the charitable status number in Canada to be able to be eligible. I think in some cases there are U.S. organizations that can emit sometimes if they have a sister organization in Canada, but you'd have to double check. So I make donations all over the world, and I only can claim my Canadian charities. So unfortunately, I think that for like international organizations, I don't think it's possible. And that's a big limitation for a lot of international organizations, which is why they tend to have a fiscal sponsor in Canada or the US that is able to give out tax receipts in their name. But
Okay.
yeah, I'm not
Yeah,
sure.
as I say, I just thought I'd throw that in there while
No
we're talking.
problem.
Can I ask you a personal question before we close?
Of course you can.
Now, you may have touched on this before I clicked record, but you've been immersed in all of this, nonprofits, fundraising, all that for most of your life. What does a completely non-productive but perfect day look like for you?
A non-productive day to me is not a perfect day. I need to feel productive to feel like it's a perfect day.
But does it have to be productive in the fundraising nonprofit arena?
Honestly, and this, I'm not just saying this, I absolutely love what I do. When I get to go, what I really, really like is the field work, like actually going to go with an organization in the field and not just be behind my screen. So, for example, a perfect day the other day was when I got to go to the shelter for the first time that I've been funding and helping raise funds for them for a year, take a whole bunch of cute photos with the dogs. And then with my own dogs, we got to go to the new shelter land that's empty and take drone footage of what it's going to be next. And for me, that was absolutely wonderful to be able to be at the beginning stages of a new project and then confirming that I'm going to be flying with one of the dogs. And like for me, those things is really what makes my day happy. I really, really enjoy them. But also with my husband, we travel a lot, as I mentioned earlier. So we're constantly traveling. So for me, a nice day where we're on a road trip with the puppies and we get to stop at different places, try food in different restaurants while I'm working in between on my computer from our truck. For me, that's a wonderful day because I get to still do my work, which I love, but also get to explore the world with the puppies and my husband. So for me, that's doesn't get much better. Food, give me food, I'll be happy.
Okay. No, actually, I have, because of our pre-record conversation, I have a second question for you. You mentioned that you were outfitting, you were camperizing your truck, your van, something like that.
Yes, a truck. Yeah.
Is this just for like little trips, or are you going to become a
No.
full-time nomad?
Full-time nomad. It's been our plan for how many years?
And
Eight?
so are
I don't
you
know.
staying in Albania and branching from there, like all that European, Middle European.
Who knows where the road will take us? Ideally, we'd love to go to Asia one day, but because of all the wars happening in certain parts of the world, the roads tend to be a bit difficult for some countries that make it very challenging to go through. But if we can get there, we will. So basically, we're building up this truck. Hopefully, it'll be done within the next 2 weeks, the basic structure. And then, as you may know, in Europe, you can only stay for 3 months out of 6 months. So Albania has opposite. So I can stay in Albania for 3 months, then go to Europe for 3 months, and we can go. So there's different parts of Europe that we want to visit. So far, we've only been to Hungary. We've been to Greece. We're going back to Greece to the islands this summer. We're going to Italy. I'm gonna get fat, eating pizza and pasta and gelato. But yeah, just
Okay. Okay, I
traveling
have an ulterior motive. It's okay.
around.
I mentioned that I've interviewed a couple of nomads. They've all been
Do
North
you want to
America.
do it too?
I'm not sure yet. I'm definitely Canada. That's, yeah. But where I'm going with this is when you've been doing this for a while, will you contact me and come back on podcasts and talk about nomading in Europe?
Of course, it would be my pleasure.
I would love to hear more, and I'm sure we've got lots of listeners who, because this whole nomad thing is a like, and for me it wouldn't be a full time, like a permanent position. It would be maybe a year or something like that. But it's got that allure, and
What makes Europe better for that is that it's not as cold. So for winters, you can go to a lot of more like in the south of Italy or in the south of Spain. And it's not hot, but it's not freezing. So there's and you can also just like pop on over to Morocco or something. So that's kind of our plan for the winters. But also because in Europe There's no borders. It's a lot easier to travel around. And with dogs, that was kind of our big reason. We didn't, I don't want to go travel through the States. No, thank you. And going through Europe with our dogs was easy because we got a European passport for them and we can just travel. So there's a lot of pros and cons, but I will definitely let you know. Oh, I just put my hand in my dirty shoes. Let's keep in touch. And I'll definitely be able to maybe in a year or so let you know where we are in the world. That's the number one question my clients and my friends ask me when we go on Zoom calls. So where are you? It's a fun question to answer.
Well, I hope you have people that you talk to regularly and relatively often, because then the answer changes every time.
It does all
A
the
little
time.
map on the wall, and there's pins wherever that we're finding
I
Catherine's
need
this
to
week.
do that. I need to do that. And it's like it has to move around. I'll just like post a photo on Facebook. Okay, this is where I am now. Because my family, my mom stopped trying to understand. She's like, I lost track. I lost
That's great. Catherine, thank you so much. Your website link is in the show notes, and all of your links are on your page at our website. Send me a picture of Mr. Pickles. I mean, he's got to
will
be part of
send.
this.
I wish he was here. He's adorable. He's my little
Well, no,
fluffy.
I want a
He's
picture for your page at our
I will.
website.
I'll do it.
Listeners, I'd really love to hear your thoughts on this one. Is there a cause that's close to your heart right now, or something you've been thinking about getting involved in? Because apparently there's no wrong answers to that, is there, Catherine? Let me know in the comments. I read everyone. If this conversation made you think of someone, maybe a friend who's always giving, or someone looking for a way to start, please share this episode with them. I know as we were talking, I kept on thinking, oh, well, there's that person and this person, and like rescue greyhounds and rescue the blah, and more than just Canada. If you're not already following, oh, the podcast, you breezed past that real fast. It is called The
Just
Just
because.
Because, and that's three separate words, podcast. That link will also be on your page at our website. Back to my podcast. If you're already following, this is exactly the kind of conversation we have here every week. Real, thoughtful, a little bit unexpected. So click the follow button here. If you'd like to listen early, I release each episode on Substack on Wednesday evening before it goes live everywhere else. It's where I share episodes, and up the road, we're going to be having more conversations about those episodes. A reminder to check out the resource tab and the Start Here tab at boomwithabang.com. You can look up previous podcast episodes. You can find books written. Have you written a book yet? No.
In the
Okay,
works.
she's shaking her head.
It's my goal. One of my goals.
Oh, okay, good. There we go. Catherine Lacefield, thank you for being my guest today. Reminding us that, giving back, it doesn't have to be complicated, but it can be incredibly meaningful. So thank you for that.
My pleasure.
Have a great rest of the week.